Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking income inequality, progressive taxation, and all those things that we discuss on ad nauseum across the Tortoise Shack. But I'm actually joined by two experts in the field, and I'm rejoined by, for the third time, by UCC's economist Seamus Coffey, former head of the Fiscal Advisory Council. Seamus, good to talk to you again.
Thanks very much, Tony. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, no, thank you for doing it. And we are joined by the Nevin Economic Research Institute's Kieran Nugent. Kieran, this is first time on Echo, but second time on the Tortoise Shack, I believe.
Yes. I was on with Martin another time as well. So this is, yeah, my third time this week.
Oh wow. So it's the first time you get to talk to the main man. So
I think you were doing, I think you were sick or something when I was talking to Martin the last time.
Listen, I won't delay. This is the genesis of this for people who follow us is some of the conversations that happen online between economists and how we view things, which was interesting. And Seamus, if you don't mind, I want to come to you because we looked at the conversation that we've had is around income inequality in Ireland and how it's measured. Do you want to give me your sense of A, is it, do you feel the metrics are accurate? And B, what do you think if it works well and what maybe could be measured better?
Yeah, I suppose in Ireland, we have a number of different sources we can use to measure different types of income inequality. I guess the most widely cited one would be the survey of income and living conditions undertaken by the CSO. It's part of an EU directive, so it's common across the 27 member states, and you get different measures of income and different measures of the income distribution from that. And that survey is actually quite important because although you can look at different sources, you can have the CSO publishing some measures, the Eurostat itself at European level publishing measures, and the OECD publishing measures of income inequality. They're all actually from the same source data. So this survey of income and living conditions is quite important. And the CSO do a lot of work in trying to make it as accurate as possible. And on the income side, one thing the CSO have via the Statistics Act is actually the ability to go to other sources and verify the data. So when it comes to income, and if you're a household in the survey of income and living conditions, the CSO will ask you for your PPS number. And then they'll go to the revenue commissioners and say, can we get the income data from there? And they'll actually look at the broader distribution in the revenue data to see does it tie in with what they're doing themselves. So they do try to verify what to do. The sample in the survey of income and living conditions is about 4,000 households, about 10 or 11,000 people. So it's actually a reasonably large sample as these things go. When it comes to surveys, none of them are perfect. And one group that surveys can definitely miss out on are those at the very, very top. They're a very small group. Even with 4,000 households, are you going to get the very highest incomes in Ireland? So the very top can be underrepresented. But again, the CSO will look at the revenue data to try and see, are they at least capturing to a certain extent those at the top? So quite an important survey. Lots of different measures. We can use things like income shares, what percentage of income is going to different groups, the Gini coefficient, looks across the entire distribution, and the at-risk of poverty rate, which is another sort of measure of inequality. So there's lots of measures out there. A lot of them are drawn from the same data source. So that data set, we would hope it is done in a very good fashion, and the CSO do put a lot of work into it. I think we're due to get that. It's like, if you look at the delay with which the CSO published the results, we haven't got the 2020 results yet, even though we're near the end of 2021, and that should be due in the next couple of weeks.
Just going to pause the podcast for a moment to ask you to help us keep going. We put these podcasts out for free. We have no ads, no sponsors. We rely totally on listeners. If you can, if you enjoy what we do, if you want to keep this viable, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options there, and there's a ton of extras. You don't, first of all, you get a dedicated RSS feed, so your podcast feed with all the podcasts across the network on one place, and you don't have these inserts, so you don't have to listen to me ask you for this. And no, I don't like doing this, but it has to be done. And it would help it tremendously if there are thousands of you listening, and there are, we need some of you to help us keep the show on the road. If you have a few quid, it's the price of a pint a month. Cheap pint as well, not one of your fancy pints. So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I know the crew will appreciate it. I know I certainly appreciate it. And we'll let you get back to the podcast. And I think you'll find this one between Seamus and Kieran you might see the value in what the tortoise shed can do, and having that conversation with two people from seemingly opposed areas of economics and maybe economic orthodoxy. I think these conversations are well worthwhile. Thanks, and we will be back soon. Just before I go to Kieran, you said that the data set is taken from the CSO, do the work, and then it's fed into these other things. But you mentioned something which is quite important. It's the at-risk of poverty ranking. In Ireland, the taxation system does a lot of the heavy lifting to take people, households, out of that. That's a very fair thing to say, yes?
Yeah, so you can look at it at different points of where people, like, so obviously the money that gets to ultimately to people's pockets is the final point, but you can look at it along the way and see what impact do different parts of our system have. And you can have the starting point generally is what's referred to as market income, the money people earn from employment and other primary income sources. And then you can look at the impact the tax system has on that. How does that reduce the level of market income inequality? And of course, people gain income through income transfers, social transfers, and other receipts, and then you get to the bottom line. In Ireland, we have very large gap between market income inequality and disposable income inequality. Like internationally, we're in or around average for disposable income inequality, neither too high nor too low, compared to other peer countries. But where we do stand out is for market income inequality. We're right up towards the top, both at EU level and at OECD level. So clearly our tax and transfer system is doing a lot. Where we actually really stand out is the tax system, the progressive nature of that, the impact that has on income inequality in Ireland is larger than in any other OECD country. And our transfer system also does a lot. So combine those two together, we go from having high levels of market income inequality, sort of your starting point, look at the top left-hand corner of a payslip, then to a kind of average levels of income inequality once you get to disposable income. So for workers, those that number at the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah, and I think that's therein lies the rub, in my opinion, that there's a cost in there, whether it be a societal one or what it is. But I'm going to go to Kieran now. And Kieran, I'd love to get your take on this, because I know you're looking at the same sort of set of data, and I wouldn't say you've both got completely different conclusions on it, but you feel that the imbalance is in, and the metrics are directed perhaps in the wrong way.
Well, it's more that, look, there's no indicator or set of indicators that are right or wrong. You want to look at everything you have and get a picture of what the income distribution looks like. So as Seamus alluded to there, there's points in the distribution. You can measure the difference between the people at the 95th percentile. That's where, you know, only 5% of households have more income than you, compared to, say, the 10th percentile. And you can do any, you know, any combination of those. And then you can look at shares as well. What does the top 10% of households, what share of the national income do they have? So it's not even that I disagree. It's just I want to bring attention and focus to areas which get less focus, in my opinion, in Irish discourse. And that's particularly around market income. And just stepping away from that for a second, we just have to always remember as well that income is an indicator on how we try and measure living standards, right? Across countries and across time. So it's not the be all and end all of inequality. You know, wealth, Ireland has extremely high wealth inequality, and it grew in years of growth there between 2013 and 2018. We got, you know, consumption-based indicators as well. So even if there is a gap between the bottom and the top, like what can the people at the bottom enjoy with the spending power of the money that they have in their particular economy, and what's the interaction there with the state? So for reasons you mentioned there, the disposable income, the end, the money that's in your account in the end or whatever, and how that's counted. Even if we're going to look at that, there's reasons to be, you know, to kind of dig in further into income inequality indicators when we're comparing Ireland against what we might call peer countries, high income countries in the European Union. And that's because we have, and I know Tony yourself and Rory and Martin have covered it on plenty of occasions, we have a cash transfer system relative to other high income countries. So HAP, housing assistance payment, which has gone up over 5 or 6 years of continuous employment and wage growth, the amount we give out on that has actually gone up in all that. 400,000 more people are working.
Well, it's gone. It's if I could put some figures on it, it's gone from nearly 250 million to nearly a billion. Shy of a billion.
So just on that point, that ends up on the balance books of low income Irish households, right? And in the end, that's part of the disposable income, which pushes up their income in a way across countries and across time, because that wasn't the case 10, 15 years ago in Ireland. When we're measuring across countries, then where a higher amount might be on, so you know, in social housing that they pay reduced rents for or whatever, it doesn't show up on their in their bank account or in the way the Silk measures this. So in another way, we're again underestimating the scale of, or at least there's more to dig into there on what that interaction is with the state across countries.
Seamus, just on that point, and I see you're nodding your head, listening to Kieran talking about some of the things he's mentioned there. But on that point, we very much know, we spoke before we came on air, that housing is a key driver of a lot of the issues that affect our economy, and they're affecting our competitiveness as well now internationally. Can I ask you, do you think that again, within the metrics that we measure, given that we've some of the highest rents in the world and some of the and some of the highest property prices, is it fair to say that as Kieran has alluded to, that we need to look at almost factor housing as the same way we kind of look at our GDP? Is that housing income really housing income, or is it just a transfer from one form of what would have been in a previous generation social housing is now effectively social housing funded via the private model?
Yeah, I think it's obviously a crucial point. Like when you're looking at households' income, clearly, one of the largest items of expenditure would be housing costs. And in Ireland, we have sort of a variety of different ways in which housing costs are funded, both by the households themselves and by the state. And when we look at all the different measures that are out there, in fact, Eurostat do a measure of the at-risk of poverty rate after subtracting housing costs. So if housing benefits are counted as income, once you subtract housing costs, well, those benefits would be subtracted. So you have the at-risk of poverty rate after housing costs, how much of your money has gone to cover your housing costs. And Ireland, in the EU 15 at least anyway, has the lowest at-risk of poverty rate after housing costs, lower than all of the other EU 15. And in a sense, it sort of stacks up with the different approaches we have. Like Kieran mentioned, the local authority system of the differentiated rents, where it's set at between 10 and 15% of income. In relative terms, that would be a low housing cost burden. And then, of course, you have the subsidized schemes for private rental. And if that is added to the household income, then it's subtracted when housing costs are lifted. So, and then, of course, you have the owner-occupiers, and particularly those who don't have a mortgage, whose housing costs would be relatively low. So we can look at housing costs across the EU. And it's perhaps surprising to see that our at-risk of poverty rate after housing costs have been subtracted is the lowest in the EU 15.
And hey, Kieran,
can I just get in there now? I might tweet something out after this as we do, James. But I was under the impression that those housing costs and that's why, you know, we're looking around, we're like, if homelessness has gone up, if, you know, deprivation, there's another issue I'd like to get to if we'll come back to it, is deprivation indicators, how much we can buy, how much, you know, how much we go without.
Well, we'll get there, Kieran, but
yeah, I was just under the impression that those within that indicator, the, you know, you might subtract an average cost of housing or whatever, but within that indicator, your housing supports are still counted within. So that HAP is there. And that's why the EU 15, that's why we look good in an EU 15 comparison. But we'll hopefully we won't take 7 hours on the next time. We'll trash that out a little bit on Twitter afterwards. Sometimes it's good, but I don't have my state of package.
Can we look at, though, I think it's fair to say, can we look at then, given that our market income inequality is so high, is there an argument, and I'll go back to you again, Seamus, is there an argument that some of the, you know, we're hearing things about the budget, we got an extra 30 cent on the minimum wage, which is still, you know, a full, is it 2.50 now away from what has been deemed the living wage? It is, yeah, it's €2.50 exactly away from what has been deemed the living wage. Are we looking at a point where what is actually happening in effect is the state is subsidizing some employers to pay these low wages by way of these social transfers, whether it's HAP, whether it's the old rent assistance, whether it's pensions make up a large part of some households that, you know, multi-generational families with it, and the pension helps lift that family out of that at risk of poverty trap.
It's all interconnected. Like there's no way of looking at these things in isolation. And like when it comes to low pay, like I think in Ireland we have maybe a sort of a different approach to certain sectors as opposed to other countries you might be comparing ourselves to, particularly in say hospitality and retail, where many of the staff are on low pay and tend to be much younger. So the arguments in favour of a living wage would perhaps be that we should make those sectors much more viable in terms of a long-term full-time employment, rather than being sort of the transitory, temporary sort of nature we have at the moment. And that is maybe a laudable objective. But one thing our system sort of has facilitated, I think, in terms of employment, is actually participation in third-level education. And now maybe people shouldn't have to go and get a job to fund themselves through third-level education. But I think it's something that does happen quite significantly. If you look at the numbers of people in employment, so we have, 2.3 million people in employment. When the CSO do the labour force survey, they ask these people, what's your principal economic status? And of course, you think of the 2.3 million people working that at work would be that their principal economic status. But actually, for 100,000 of what we count as the number employed, they're actually their principal economic status is student. It's close on a quarter of the number of students over 15. And of course, most of those will be in part-time employment. But I think it's, in a sense, it's kind of a reverse that because the employment is sort of unattractive for other people, it becomes attractive for students and then a way of funding them through college. So maybe we should change our system for keep as many people through college as currently happening, but change the way it's funded and maybe look then at what type of employment do we have in the retail and the accommodation hospitality sectors, because there's no doubt in Ireland we do things differently. And it is one that is has a much higher prevalence of lower pay than other countries.
Aaron, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that.
Just let's talk about what the minimum wage is and what the living wage is for the moment, right? The minimum wage is the legal wage. It's ironed out by, used to be the social partners, and now it's, you know, it's the low wage commission. And we set a number that seems to, you know, satisfy the people in those rooms. The living wage is calculated and is aspirational wage that is calculated on a minimum essential standard of living, right? And if you look into how that's, you know, it's a bit boring to some people, but if you look into how that is calculated, it's extremely minimum essential, right? There's no, you know, there's no we all party too hard about it or anything like that, right? So there's two, as you said, there's 250, 260, so somewhere in that area, 20% in the difference. So it is literally a dependency wage, the minimum wage, right? The living wage is based on a 39-hour week as well, which is something that's often lost. And in Dublin, it's even more, right? So if you're living 20, you know, if you're working 20 hours a week on the minimum wage, you're going to be taking in less than half of the living wage in Dublin, right? So by that, by definition, then you cannot live independently on this wage. So this is why, you know, it comes in now that minimum wage workers are scattered throughout the distribution of households, because they're, you know, 25-year-olds who can't move out, or they're, whatever, they can't move out because that wage will not allow them to move out. So, and let's also remember, just this is important now as we emerge from this and we don't make the same mistakes as we made 12 years ago in terms of austerity and in terms of the, this is important in terms of the battle of ideas, right? So this week, the Nobel Prize was given to an economist who found that minimum wage increases do not have a big impact on employment, right? And that immigration, it was especially one of his studies was on immigrants bringing down the wages at the bottom, which was, you know, found not to be the case. So we've got this gap between, big gap between minimum wages and living wages. With 20% of Irish employees are on what's called a low wage, which is, Germany is about the only other country in our kind of group of high income EU countries that has the same. So as you said, you get this, you're either dependent on living with your parents, you're dependent on a higher earner, you're dependent on bunk beds if you're a delivery driver, an immigrant delivery driver in Dublin with four to a room, or you're dependent on the state through HAP, through supplementary welfare allowance as well, and a raft of other income supports to make sure these people don't end up homeless. So I just think that's important. The 30-cent increase this in this budget is very disappointing.
But Kieran, I accept that, and I think there's an argument that to be had, not just about that, but about the actual fact that, you know, we look at how we balance that. But I suppose if you wanted to really drill down into it, are we still looking at a case whereby, and again, you wanted to talk about deprivation, how it's measured. Yeah. So I think back to what Emma Kirwan said to me a few years ago when he talked about a life delayed. And maybe, and Seamus, you teach students, and some of them, are different. They come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. But there is very much an argument you made that there is a generation now that are living that life delayed. And it's because of some of the ways our income distribution works in Ireland.
I suppose we can look for evidence of that. Like one thing that the SILT gives us is adults living at home. And Ireland will be a country where our outcome for that is much higher than other countries. Similar to the likes of Italy and Portugal, maybe Greece, but much higher than the Nordic countries, who by the time people get to even their early 20s, most of them have left home. Our rates for people even up to 25, 29, and into the early 30s are much higher. And I guess like... I'm sorry, Karen?
And gotten worse over the last
couple of years. It is one that has increased since 2015, 2016. And like, given the improvement that was in the economy, you wouldn't perhaps expect that to happen. But I suppose it's linked to a related problem we have in Ireland with housing, that yes, we can improve income, but we also have to improve our housing situation. So I think, like, if we're looking for evidence for what Kieran is talking about, we can see it in that one, the share of adults who are living at home.
Can I ask both of you, and probably Kieran first, is when you look at that though, in terms of that the people who are living at home, the generation that aren't, they're worse off than their parents were when they were at that stage. As we look at back to this, some of the revisionism, and Seamus, this isn't having a go at you. You were on the Fiscal Advisory Council during the worst shit we had. Like, okay, so that's the reality. But we also heard now some of the narratives are that, you know, we austerity'd our way out of the doldrums. It's still written in some of our mainstream things, and I just happen to disagree with that profoundly, and think that, you know, it was actually when the EU said we do everything it takes to save the euro that we started to see prices come down. We could borrow cheaply and we could start to invest in services. Kieran, and yet we still see in this budget, I would call it a conservative budget relative to what the fiscal rules allow.
Yeah, so, right, there has been a bit of a reckoning in some places, not really in the Irish government, it seems, but, you know, the European Commission even came out, one of their spokespeople there very recently, and said austerity was a mistake. you know, austerity did not contribute to 26% GDP growth in 2016. You know, it had nothing to do. The sectors that drove our recovery in the early years were pharmaceuticals, it was on IT, and there was no wage restraint there. And keeping the minimum wage down or cutting public sector workers' wages have no impact on how much, you know, Viagra, Pfizer sell across the world in 2013. So, which was, you know, one of the this is the areas where it was driving. Now, in around that time as well, 3 or 4 years into austerity, it kind of came about that this paper, which was the kind of economic justification for austerity, Alessina Ardania, I think it was called. It happened to coincide with cultural and political kind of beliefs in our biggest in EU's driving industrial base in Germany, and it was handy then to we're going to cut our way out of this. And what's going to happen is when we cut our wages, then international investors will be more comfortable because they won't forecast that we're going to have to raise taxes in the future. So they are going to invest now, right? And that didn't work. And then the paper came out, and then it was, okay, now it's jobless households. That's the problem. It's not our austerity, it's jobless households. Jobless households that didn't exist 4 or 5 years before. Jobless households that aren't really unique in an Irish context. The amount of jobless households in Ireland aren't necessarily that high internationally. There's a reckoning about that now. The business cycle, it comes back around. Anyway, eventually, things settle. People, sort their finances out and go back to the shops. And so that's what happened there eventually. And it was nothing to do with austerity. And austerity, very likely and most likely, and there's a burgeoning consensus.
But I need to move it on because I want to ask, we've just hit the budget. And I think, Seamus, by some estimates, given... I think there was a gap of between what we thought we'd need to borrow, what we actually borrowed, and what we got in additional tax receipts of about 14 billion. And you know, the two lads were lauded as they did well to hide those figures from the other departments because they said, listen, we're coming out of COVID, things are bad. Turns out things weren't as bad as advertised. And if we were as we were told, we had to play within the fiscal rules. I think it's an under it's. I'm being conservative to say we left about 2.5 billion in additional spending on the table that we could have used from the money that was available.
I'm not sure of the mechanics of how that applies. And I think, but there definitely was announcements close to the budget about improvements in tax revenues. But I don't think we should be basing our budgetary policy, which we set over a couple of years, on figures that come out just a couple of days before the budget. And essentially, it was just changes in the amount of money we were borrowing. It wasn't. In a sense that we had found money somewhere that was available to spend. Like, we should be spending money on housing, education, health, social welfare every year, not just when we get a temporary bump in a certain source of revenue. So I think we should be looking to put the public finance on a more sustainable. That doesn't mean you can't increase. Of course you could increase, but it should be increased on the basis of sustainable revenue. So if we want to spend more,
Michael Taft,
have a better base.
Michael Taft put it to me that we'd have to have gone to up to 5 billion just per rata to be on the same footing in terms of spending as, say, Germany and France in this year's budget. 5 billion additional seems, you know, it's a lot of money, Seamus, that we could have done. Now, again, I haven't got Michael's figures in front of me, but...
So I don't know what figures he was in, but like they raise additional money. Like how do those countries have... higher levels of government spending as a share of their economy. They have higher levels of government revenue as a share of their economy. If we want to, and there's no reason why we couldn't choose to go to having higher levels of government spending, it should be accompanied with higher levels of revenue. Like I don't think we should have our expenditure on housing, health, education, all those other sectors dependent on whether ECB policy is loose or not. ECB policy is about the overall economy. And yes, it's clearly having an impact on government finances around the world as we go through the pandemic. But we must be thinking over the long term. And if we want to do these things, which I think we do, we should put them on a sustainable footing. You're getting me to put my fiscal council hat back on again. Karen, I took that off.
Karen, I see you want to come in there. Go ahead.
And, you know, I agree. And I just don't think we're having that conversation. We're clearly not having that conversation with that budget that we've just seen in terms of how much revenue we raise. And my colleagues, Tom McDonnell and Paul Galdrick-Kelly, wrote a paper and identified that if we're, again, to compare ourselves to the averages in our comparator high-income EU countries, that we collect somewhere in the region of 10 billion less. If we came up to averages, especially in employers' PRSI, which I've never really heard, you know, voiced publicly, not like in, you know, traditional media or anything like
that.
Well,
actually, I'm going to push back and say the Taoiseach said only a couple of weeks ago that he didn't agree with his own government's decision to start to increase employers' PRSI between now and 2030. He thought it was too high an ask on certain employers.
Oh, well, good. Okay.
And I thought that was interesting because obviously that goes to Seamus's point of, we don't think long term because this is thinking in terms of politics, the next election, and who your voter base is. That would be my opinion on that. When I see someone, you know, make what is in a sense a nod and a wink to you, what you would think of as your voter base. Sorry, go ahead, Kieran. I know I cut in there.
No, your analysis is right there. I just didn't hear the and that's very new. Anyway, the last few weeks, so we should have really been having this. We should have been having this conversation a long time ago, and if we're starting to have it now, it means we're not getting anywhere, especially if it's the opposite of what everybody else thinks coming from the Taoiseach. So as Seamus says, you know, if we're getting the word competitiveness is coming back in now again with this, what I see is, you know, we're hearing that it's hard to recruit now, and I don't think any of this is actually borne out by any of the figures. We'll see now in a couple of months. But we're back to competitiveness and learning the wrong lessons from the financial crisis. Wages had nothing to do with the financial crisis of 2008, and we're back to competitiveness in tourism, basically. That's the only place where wage competitiveness matters in an Irish context. The rest of the place, when you want to compete with the, well, if you want to call it the big boys, the developed countries or whatever, your competitiveness comes from your infrastructure. It comes from your education base. It comes from IT skills. It comes from prices. So if you look at
it comes from housing as well, mate.
The cost of housing, price is the biggest one. I wrote a blog on it a couple of weeks ago and I showed that there's a couple of indices. There's a few different international, you know, organizations that do these competitiveness indices. And one of them had Ireland in terms of prices as our worst, and we were up there. We're always in the kind of top 20 anyway. And you see that top 10 especially are all high income countries, right? By like, you know, Norway, Japan, America, Singapore, these kinds of, and a lot of mostly European countries. So competitiveness, you know, if we want to manufacture runners and compete with Vietnam or China, that's when the minimum wage comes into competitiveness, right? But we're hearing that again now on the airwaves, so we have to worry about competitiveness and wages getting out of control. Wages weren't the problem the last time, and they're not going to be the fix this time. They're not going to be the fix to us growing, and they're not going to be the fix for us, you know, helping living standards for a big chunk of Irish workers.
Okay, okay, and again, we got to keep this moving on, but just on those, on say, Seamus, first of all, I'd like to get your take on what Kieran has just said in terms of prices and competitiveness becoming again a drum that's being beaten.
Yeah, I think it's something we can hear in the commentary, and I think one thing that Kieran perhaps left out there is a lot of the noise is around taxation. So we've had a pretty significant decision when it came to corporation tax a few weeks ago. But a lot of the reaction seemed to be that we had to ensure our competitiveness on the personal income tax side. That in some way, whatever competitive losses were to be felt via the increase in corporation tax could be offset by lower personal income tax. But I'm not sure that's a key driver of the investment decisions.
Which doesn't seem to work. Doesn't seem to work at all.
If that was the case, investment would be going to places that don't have income taxes, and that doesn't happen. So it is something we're hearing. and maybe it doesn't psychoanalyze. And I think going back to what Kieran said, like, a key difference between Ireland and other countries when it comes to government revenue is employers' social insurance. Now, they do use the revenue differently. So like, a lot of it is linked to pensions. And in Ireland, our state pension scheme is pay-related for the contributions. But of course, the benefits are flat. If you've made sufficient contributions, everybody gets the same amount. Whereas in other countries where they would have much more substantial contributions, particularly by the employers, sometimes up to 30% of the gross pay of the employee, the benefits received then are relative to the contributions made. So in France, if you've had contributions made based on a salary, say, of 80,000, the pension you get is based on the contributions from a salary of 80,000. Whereas in Ireland, the level of the contributions you've made don't impact that. Now, I do think we're beginning to change, and hopefully we're adding different elements to our pension system, so that the state pension should remain the bedrock of our system. But hopefully we can get autumn enrolment to actually happen, and that would see a bigger contribution from employers, and perhaps bring us more in line to what happens in other countries. And I've read the paper that the Kieran mentioned earlier. It is definitely down to, a large part of the difference between Ireland and other countries is our sort of approach to pensions. We could have additional contributions from employers and then use those to fund sort of a pillar two or a higher level pension scheme.
We could also have a wealth tax, but we need to look at those. Can I ask one last thing before? Because actually, it wasn't something I thought I'd ask today, but Kieran, you mentioned Vietnam, and I had Tao on from Vietnam recently as a member of the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. And I don't know if you heard the clip even. It was really stark. It was the first question I put to her, and she just literally went at me and said, you know, in Ireland, you charge 5%, some people 0%, and you're so proud of it. And I stopped cold. When it comes to this new global minimum corporation tax deal, and we see how dependent our actual budget is every year on how much we take in from corporation taxes, and how we've underestimated them, by the way, for the last 5 or 6 years. There's always, they outperformed what the estimates were from the department. There's an additional billion, there's an additional 1.3 billion, and this year it was an additional 1.7 billion in corporation taxes. We are really facing possibly the biggest challenge to us, because since the time we were so dependent on the construction taxes, you know, this is it all over again. How do you think we wean ourselves off this? And then maybe the same question to you, Seamus, just before we wrap.
Well, look, you know, Noam Chomsky made some pretty harsh comments there during the week about ourselves, and I don't think it's uneasy with us, I think. But at the same time, you know, obviously you're a guest as somebody who was proud of that. I don't know if any, maybe they just to say that in front of me.
No. I had guests who were from across the world, from every continent.
Yeah,
had said Ireland. Effectively, one of them said Ireland is effectively able to mean we get 1,300 fewer nurses, for example, in how some of this is facilitated. So it was.
Well, the way to wean it off is, first of all, the biggest part of that is what I already mentioned there in terms of employers' contributions to PRSI. That's the biggest gap. There's areas, you know, net wealth taxes and inheritance taxes that can also contribute, but they won't contribute as much. They're not the big ticket items. Obviously, increasing minimum wage, living wage, we'll get more income tax. Maybe a third band of income tax at 100,000, 80,000, something like that for particularly high earners. And if we're spending that money on kind of social goods to bring down, you know, wage pressures, help competitiveness, this should have a virtuous circle then in terms of productivity and eventually, you know, bringing ourselves up to European norms of taxation from income taxes as well. So that would be we're really entering Seamus's area here, so I'm afraid to say any out of step. But if you know,
he's not a monster.
there's those two pillars now to be concerned about of the BEPS treaty or whatever it's called now.
BEPS. Yeah.
So one where, you know, I know I've seen Seamus writing on this. one we might lose on this kind of, you know, was it their taxes that we booked here kind of thing on one pillar. And then the other one, I find the commentary around the funny, that we're, you know, is the minimum 15%. And then, you know, we're not going to lose anything off that if there's nowhere for anyone else to go. That's going to be, you know, that are going to be allowed charge less than 15%. There's, you know, well,
there's a whole other we need to get into what they pay for R&D and how that else works as well. But that's a different story. Seamus, if we keep it broad on that today, if you give me your final thoughts on that, I think it's a really important question facing our. You said we should be planning long term. We shouldn't be counting on, you know, a windfall from corporation tax or any particular source. How do we wean ourselves off?
Yeah, so we don't know what's going to happen with those receipts. They're clearly at a very elevated level. Like, so the budget had a figure for this year that there'll be 14 billion in 2021. Like, you're heading for around 3,000 euro per capita in corporate tax receipts. Like, if you look at the likes of France, they collect around 1,000 euro per capita in corporate tax receipts. So while they might be collecting more when it comes to employer social insurance contributions, we're certainly collecting more when it comes to corporate tax. And I don't know, can we rely on this out over the medium term? As Ciarán said, the international system is changing. And where does Ireland sit within that international system? Like, we've had various commentary over the past while about Ireland stealing tax revenue from other countries. Like, there's no law we could pass in Ireland that gets companies to pay their tax here rather than somewhere else. So, like, that's not the way international taxation works. At present, the system for taxing companies is that companies pay their tax where they have their activities, where they have their risks, their functions, their activities, where they are located is where they pay the tax. So Ireland has a low tax jurisdiction for companies, and we've attracted significant amounts of investment. So that's why they're paying additional tax in Ireland. Could a system change where companies will have their activities in different countries? Yes. Or maybe, as we're seeing with this current round of BEPS, could the system for how companies are taxed change? And one of the pillars Ciarán referred to there is going to do that. It won't be that in certain circumstances companies pay their tax based on where their activities are. They'll pay their tax based on where their customers are. And this is a huge shift from a system that has been in place for 100 years. But it's only a huge shift for a small group of companies and a small amount of their tax, at least initially. But now the principle has been set that companies don't pay tax where they have their activities. They pay tax where their customers are. And from an Irish perspective, like, we're a huge exporting country. We manufacture lots of products, whether it's pharmaceuticals, computer processors, soft drink, medical devices, and a whole range of other things. But, like, we're obviously a very small market. And if more of the taxing rights to those sort of things is to go where the customers are rather than where the activities are, well, then over the medium to long term, we could lose some of that elevated tax revenue. Like, 14 billion is a huge sum. It's great to be getting it, but maybe we should be cautious about getting it over the long term.
I'm also conscious that the argument's going to move on as well, and already is in there in the US in terms of many of the what is commonly referred to as the 1% don't pay any taxes because they never make any money.
No income. Like, if you have an income tax and these people can avoid having an income, well, like, they don't pay income taxes. And, like, some of the studies are great about how they actually get money to spend. Like, so they don't have an income, but they're spending huge amounts of money. They get loans. They use assets.
They send space shuttles up to for a minute and a half, and they haven't made a cent.
And I'm sure they could use some of that as a tax deduction. I think when it comes, like, clearly looking at how companies are taxed is important. But I think internationally and in Ireland, we should be looking at some of the gaps that are in the personal tax system. The corporation tax is just sort of the first goal the tax man has at the profits earned by companies. We should then be ensuring that those profits are distributed in the form of income and are subject to personal income taxes. And in Ireland, we have a variety of ways in which that doesn't happen, maybe primarily through pension contributions, although we have reduced the limits in recent years. Maybe that's something that could be reviewed again. But for the super wealthy, as you refer to them, that own large shares in these hugely profitable companies, there should be some way of deeming them to have an income that becomes subject to personal income taxes.
Ciarán, have you any last thoughts before we wrap?
No, I was just struck by one example. We're just talking about ways I know you talk about housing a lot and ways to get around income tax and higher earners and just specifically in terms of the cost of rent. Something that I don't think is highlighted enough is, you know, a lot of kind of international high wage IT workers or pharmaceutical workers who might come into Ireland for 1 or 2 years, you know, they'll get a €20,000 rent kind of bonus to spend directly on their living costs, pushing up rents across the country as well. It's actually income, but it's not counted in that way.
We still have SARP, like a decade after the temporary facility of SARP is supposed to come in. We still have it. And, you know, so they can pay a flat rate of 30% on a nominated individual in these. But I suppose if you allow me to summarize, I'd say the solutions, there's no silver bullet for any of this, guys. We need a gun packed with many different things that we need to take out and take on. And I do think we're all pulling in the one direction. We all, even when we disagree, and it was nice to have this conversation, and I really appreciate you both doing it. I actually genuinely do, and I think the listeners will get a lot out of it because I know I have. So I do want to just look. We've done an hour there, folks. So thanks so much to Seamus Coffey and Kieran Nugent for taking the time to talk to us. We will be back in your feeds very soon, and we hope that you will come along to our live show on the Sugar Club on the 10th of November. If you dance at the table, I believe we can get more people in. If you're going to sit down at the table, we can't sell many tickets. Talk to you all very soon. Take care.
All right, well, thanks.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on